Good evening, one and all. Yes, Tuesday and another week, and it's September. I know, it flies, doesn't it? And it's actually quite nice, sort of like almost autumnal weather here in Connecticut today. My guest knows about that because she's in Connecticut as well. But yeah, after the hot weather we've had and then the rain we've had, it's now more my sort of weather, you know, about 70 and not so humid and everything like that. But we are here. And of course, with everything else going on, not only in the world, with all the politics going on in America, and every evening there's something else told to us, whether we believe it or not, it's another matter. But what about all this started? I mean, if you look back, and especially at this time where you've got movements like Women's March and Me Too and that sort of thing, of united and ignited women across the country, where did it go back to? What about when the Declaration of Independence was made? You know, because that was, in those days, it was all men, and it's you know, he's and lack of women mentioned there. But where can we sort of trace stuff back to, and how it's gone through to today? Well, my guest, she can explain a lot of that, because she's got a new book out, and it's a great book. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But I'd better introduce my guest first, haven't I? Because on the show today, I have the one and only Dr. Julie Sook. Hi, Julie. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. Thanks so much for having me on your show.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. As I said, you know, at this time, obviously, more and more power to the women, which is great. You know, women across the whole country, the whole world, in many cases, have sort of become ignited, shall I say, you know, in against this. But what about when we go back to the early days of America and the Declaration of Independence? I doubt if they even got a look in then, did they?
Well, when the Declaration of Independence was written in 1776, it was a legal order both in the United States and in other parts of the world, including Britain, where women did not really have the same legal rights as men. And in fact, married women did not have many of the legal rights that we associate with being a person under the law, including property rights or the right to keep your own earnings if you ever worked for pay, or the right to exercise parental authority over your own children. So these were rights that women were excluded from in the legal system that existed in America at the time. And of course, the Declaration of Independence didn't necessarily speak to that. The Declaration of Independence declared the independence of the United States from Britain. But what was really interesting is that it declared that all men are
equal. Men are equal, yeah, that's what I was thinking, yes. Yeah, that, when I sort of was talking about it, that's the term that came to mind. It doesn't say that we are all equal. It does say men, doesn't it, specifically?
It does. And although, well, it's not really clear whether they meant men, only men, or men and women, if they were using the word men in a more generic way. But it's very interesting that by the time that the Constitution of the United States, that is currently in force today, went into effect in 1789, when that Constitution was written, it actually spoke of we the people, not we the men, but we the people. But it's not very clear who was included in We the People. And so much of the struggle in the United States about the Constitution and changing the Constitution over time has focused on really who is included in We the People and how do we repair the fact that many people did not have equal rights at the founding of the United States. And this includes not only women at the founding, but also African Americans.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, they didn't have a say for a long while, did they? You know, till after, basically after the Civil War. I can't remember when they had the vote. It was a long while. When this sort of declaration was signed, I seem to remember something about the wife of one of the Adams.
John Adams.
Yeah.
Yes, John Adams, who became the second president of the United States. So Abigail Adams, his wife.
That's it, Abigail, yeah. Sorry.
while he was going to the convening in Philadelphia that would produce the Declaration of Independence in 1776, and she wrote a letter that's become quite famous and is often quoted, where she said, to him in the letter, when you write the new code of laws for the new nation, remember the ladies. And what she meant by that was make sure that men do not have so much power over women. Do not repeat the tyranny that we're complaining about. That is, there was a movement that led to the Declaration of Independence and the American Revolution and the war against Britain, and that was really about tyranny. It was about the fact that Americans, the colonists, were actually not represented, were taxed without being represented. And so this idea that you should not be bound by laws that you had no say in making, she was trying to make that same argument about the status of women in her letter. She said that if we're not represented, if we don't have a voice in the laws that apply to us, then how can such laws be legitimate? And so in that letter, she said that the ladies are going to foment a rebellion if this continues. And my book, of course, is about that rebellion. It was a different kind of rebellion from the American Revolution. The American Revolution was a violent revolution and a war. The rebellion that women fomented was not violent, and it took many, many years because it was a rebellion that involved persuasion and following the rules of constitutional change to make sure that women's rights were included.
Right, and your book, of course, is We the Women, the Unstoppable Mothers of the Equal Rights Amendment, the ERA. And there's a lot of sort of stuff going through them and stuff like that, but has anything been sort of thought of? I don't know if it's that easy to change the amendments, is it?
Well, one of the big problems in the United States with the Constitution is that it's actually very difficult to amend compared to constitutions in other countries. Our amendment rule, which is in Article 5 of the Constitution, requires that both houses of Congress adopt an amendment by 2/3 vote. And then after that, you're not done. You need 3/4 of the state legislatures to ratify the amendment. And if you think about how diverse and divided this country is, especially today, it's very hard to imagine 2/3 of both houses of Congress agreeing on anything.
If they decided to discuss the color of the sky, they'd disagree, wouldn't they? I mean,
well, sure.
It's like that. It's interesting because when you look back, even though this was sort of discussed in those days, to my mind, it wasn't till after the First World War, after the Second World War, because the women in Europe had to take over the jobs of the men and had to do this and flew the planes and everything like that, that they started being even looked at in an equal right. And yet, you know, you go back a couple of hundred years before and it was being discussed, and it just never, you know, there was always, I guess they never didn't have the power. I mean, I'm thinking of when Margaret Thatcher, for instance, became Prime Minister, and the shock and awe that the woman was Prime Minister of, you know, one of the leading countries in the world, sort of thing. Even though she'd been Ministry of Education before that and stopped our school milk at schools when I was there. But yeah, as a Prime Minister, I mean, and it's funny, actually, enough, my daughter's called me yesterday, she said, who do you think, Dad, I've got to do an essay, and who do you think is, you know, made the most of 20th century? And she said, should it be Winston Churchill? I said, no, I think it's Margaret Thatcher more, and even more than Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill had the wartime bit, but I think overall, Margaret Thatcher was even more of a, you know, a change than that. But yeah, it's amazing how it goes. But yeah, you, as you said, you go back to the Constitution and through that, but there must have been other people along the way that have really made a mark on, you know, getting the equal rights for women into various parts of the country.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the movement for equal rights, equal legal rights of women, really begins in the middle of the 19th century. And this is where the Declaration of Independence is actually very important, because in 1848, this is, of course, after Abigail Adams is long dead. Mm-hmm. In 1848, there was a women's rights convention at Seneca Falls, organized by Lucretia Mott and Elizabeth Cady Stanton.
Okay.
And there they produced a document. I mean, women had been organizing both against slavery and in favor of women's rights for some time. before 1848, but 1848 is still a very important moment because the document that is produced, authored largely by Elizabeth Cady Stanton, used the Declaration of Independence as the model. And so the language in the Declaration of Sentiments on the Rights of Women really echoes the language of the Declaration of Independence. And it refuses to abide by the tyranny of men over women in much the same way that the Declaration of Independence refused to abide by the tyranny of England over the colonies. And so the idea that you need to bring democracy to the family, that women do not have legal rights because of the expectation that they stay home and take care of children without having any real autonomy in decisions affecting the economic life of the family and decisions affecting women's economic status in the event that things didn't go so well in the family. So these are things that really matter in 1848, and in fact, women demand the vote in that document, in the Declaration of Sentiments.
Oh, right, back then. Okay.
They demand the right to vote, yeah. But part of the reason they wanted the right to vote was not just so that they could have power for its own sake. They really wanted to vote so that they could change all the laws that kept them down and kept them subordinate within the family and kept them outside of any kind of economic rights, outside of the possibility of exercising a profession. And that's when the vote was also demanded in this particular declaration. But of course, after demanding it in 1848, it's not until 1920 that the constitutional amendment guaranteeing women the right to vote is ratified. 1920.
So wow. It's a good long while.
Seven decades after the movement gets started.
Was it when it came to the vote, were some states before others, before it wasn't sort of like over the whole of America, was it, that they got the vote, wasn't it? Was it different states before other states or something?
So in the Western territories, in Western states, places like Wyoming and Montana, women had the vote much sooner, early as the late 19th century. But this was one of the problems. I mean, and initially, women suffragists believed that the strategy should be to work on each state, one state at a time. And that strategy made some sense in the context of the U.S. Constitution, because one thing that's unique about the U.S. Constitution, as compared to many other constitutions around the world, is that it doesn't actually guarantee citizens the right to vote. The U.S. Constitution has always taken the view that it's up to states to define who gets to vote. And so what that meant, and that's what states did. So in some states, women actually had the right to vote, but other states had constitutions that said that only men could vote. And it's because of those states that had constitutions that limited the franchise only to men that women suffragists at one point decided that you couldn't have a state-by-state strategy. You needed a federal constitutional amendment that made it unconstitutional once and for all for any state to deny anyone the right to vote because of their sex.
What was the last state that adopted it? Can you remember?
The last state that ratified the 19th Amendment was Tennessee. But what's very interesting, of course, is that so Tennessee became the 36th state, and under the rule, you need three-fourths of the states, and back in 1920, that meant you needed 36 states. So today we have additional states, and so you need 38 states to make an amendment. But when Tennessee ratified in 1920, that was enough to add the amendment to the Constitution. Very interestingly, there are some states that were really late to the party, so some states continued to ratify. Continued to ratify well into the 1950s. Virginia is an example. Virginia didn't even ratify the 19th Amendment until 1952.
Wow.
And I mentioned Virginia specifically because Virginia became a very important state in the battle for women's constitutional rights just this year by becoming that 38th state to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment, which is an amendment different from the suffrage amendment, which would, if added to the Constitution, guarantee equality of rights under the law without abridgment by the United States or by any state on account of sex. And Virginia became that last date this year to ratify the amendment.
That's the reason I asked, because I seem to remember that it was, you know, almost like when I was born that the final sort of state took over, and you just clarified that. In your book, We the Women, do you go through sort of key figures, you know, throughout this period of, you know, the equal rights, trying to get the equal rights through?
Yes.
So who stands out that people might not, you know, a name that somebody might not know but did a heck of a lot for it? I mean, I know...
Well, one...
Go ahead.
One really important figure is Crystal Eastman, and I think she's often forgotten. And part of the reason she's often forgotten was that one of her strengths was her interest in a whole range of issues connected to justice and women's rights. So she not only worked on the women's right to vote on behalf of the National Woman's Party, and then she worked on the Equal Rights Amendment, but she was also very involved with the international peace movement. She was also a real defender of civil liberties during World War I, when civil liberties were under threat because of national security concerns. And so she was actually someone who worked with Alice Paul. Alice Paul is actually quite well-known in the United States because she made the suffrage movement much more militant in its tactics than it had been prior to her involvement. And she also had spent all this time in England learning from the Pankhursts and learning some of the militant tactics. But Alice Paul also was not satisfied once the suffrage amendment was won. She immediately said, we need more than just the vote. And Crystal Eastman said, this is just the beginning. Now that we have the vote, we need to use it to get what we're really after, which is freedom for women. And that meant going back to some of the concerns that animated the Declaration of Sentiments in 1848. It meant really thinking about the ability of women to become economically independent. So if they equal rights meant you couldn't exclude women from certain jobs. Equal rights meant if women actually worked certain jobs, they would certainly have the right to own their own earnings, regardless of whether they were married. If women were married, they should have equal status to men, their husbands, over their own children. And so those are the kinds of problems that the ERA was designed to address, although it was framed in much more abstract terms. It was framed as what they called a blanket amendment. It was an amendment that would get rid of all sex discrimination under the law. Many of the forms of sex discrimination that existed in 1920, and certainly in 1923 when the amendment was introduced, excluded women from many of the rights we associate with being a full citizen in a political and legal order.
So is it sort of really too late for the ERA to change the constitution? Is that something that's an ongoing fight still carrying on?
Yes, well, it's a matter that's being debated right now, because the ERA was first introduced in 1923, but it actually didn't get off the ground. As I mentioned earlier, you need two-thirds of both houses of Congress, and that really didn't happen for at least almost 50 years after the ERA was first introduced in Congress. So by the time you get two-thirds of both houses of Congress, it's 1972, and many of the original supporters of the ERA from the 20s are dead by the time that Congress, actually, including Crystal Eastman, who died in the late 1920s. But then when Congress adopts it, it goes to the states for ratification. And what's very interesting about the ERA that was adopted in 1972 was that Congress actually put a deadline on the states for ratification. Congress said that it would be a valid amendment when ratified within 7 years by the requisite number of states. And what happened was that 35 states ratified the amendment pretty quickly, by 1977, but that's three states short of the 38 that you need to make an amendment. And so what happened is that in 1978, Congress got a little bit worried about whether or not those three additional states would come in time for the deadline, which was 1979. So Congress actually changed the deadline once. They changed it to 1982, but those three states did not come through. by 1982 either. And at that point, many people assumed that the ERA had expired and was dead. And so it wasn't really, I mean, there were a few efforts to revive it in Congress. And by revive it, I mean there was there were efforts to introduce a new version of the amendment, which would have had to be ratified all over again by 38 states. But what's very interesting is that in 2017, Nevada actually decided to ratify the version that had been floating around since the 1970s.
Okay.
Decades, like 40 years after that deadline.
Right.
So now the question is, what happens if you miss a deadline and come in late?
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of human beings have a bunch of intuitions about what should happen. You know, if you hand in a paper late to a teacher, it was due on one day, but you handed it in 3 days late. What should happen then?
Yeah.
One version of the answer is the teacher should decide whether to accept it or not, depending on what the reasons are.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
And by similar logic, and there are some court precedents that supports this logic, we can say even though the deadline was ratified within 7 years, the deadline imposer, namely Congress, retained the power to change the deadline at any time. And, of course, that is what happened. Congress changed it once. And by that theory, Congress can change it again. And one of the ways in which it could change the deadline is by saying, we're not going to have a deadline anymore. And that's actually what the House of Representatives did earlier this year in February 2020, right after Virginia became the 38th state to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. The House of Representatives voted by a significant majority to say that they would recognize the ERA as validly ratified whenever three-fourths of the states ratified it.
Right.
But it's only gotten the vote of the House of Representatives and not the Senate right now.
Yeah, it's got to go for everything, isn't it?
Change.
Yeah. Oh, it could change.
It could change.
Yes. Right.
So the Senate could act on it. And I don't know how likely that is, given that the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, has stated publicly that he personally doesn't support the ERA.
Mm.
But certainly one thing that's very possible, this is an election year.
Exactly.
And 35 Senate seats are up for grabs. So if the composition of the Senate changes and a majority of the House remains supportive of removing the deadline, it's quite possible that sometime next year in 2021, the next session of Congress, the deadline will be removed. And if the deadline is removed, then it's not too late. The
right.
ERA can be added to the Constitution.
Add it to it. It's interesting because in your book, We the Women, the Unstoppable Mothers of the Equal Rights Amendment, I'm sure one of the people you mentioned is Susan B. Anthony. And, of course, we've just had that farce about giving a pardon, you know, and I'm ever so pleased that the Susan B. Anthony Association told them where to stick it. But is it, I mean, she was pretty powerful along the way, wasn't she, with setting the rights up?
Yes, absolutely. And Susan B. Anthony is someone who deliberately lived a life of not getting married or having children because she knew that in the 19th century it meant that you would lose all these rights.
Mm.
And she was very important. That is, Elizabeth Cady Stanton was raising 6 children. And so she, during the time that her children were young, she didn't travel around quite as much giving suffrage speeches. She was kind of the intellectual powerhouse and did a lot of writing. And Susan B. Anthony was more like the activist and organizer who
right.
traveled the country organizing for suffrage. And, of course, I mean, this whole business with the pardon is very weird because she actually deliberately...
I know. I mean, don't get me started on
that. The fact that the laws were unjust and needed right. to be changed.
Oh, that's crazy. Okay, so... what sort of response have you received from the book so far?
So it's been wonderful to talk with many different audiences, especially right now in this moment where we have been celebrating the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, which guaranteed, at least on paper, the right to vote without regard to sex.
Mm-hmm.
That is, it says that the right to vote can't be denied on account of sex. And we've been focusing rightly in this country at this moment on the right to vote because due to the pandemic, I think people are very concerned about whether or not that right can be exercised in a meaningful way this coming November. But that said, the 19th Amendment was not only about the vote. It was also about using the vote to ensure democracy within the family and to improve women's conditions economically and politically. And many of the disadvantages and inequalities that women have sustained across the generations have to do with women's role in the family. And so that's actually unfinished business from the suffragists.
Right,
and
indeed.
So one of the very interesting conversations I've had in connection with the book and the movement for equal rights is to really think of people really reflecting on the ways in which that broader agenda is still unfinished today. That is, women do have the ability to vote, but so many things that have kept women unequal economically, including women's disproportionate role in childbearing and childrearing, these are problems that we continue to think about, and problems that have become much more acute because of the pandemic. That is, because women constitute such a large portion of the essential workers, and with schools being shuttered in the United States and really all over the world, it's really the homeschooling and the extra care responsibilities tend to fall on women, which then impacts their ability to work for pay.
Yep.
And so I think that the pandemic is really driving home a lot of the issues having to do with women's role in the family that made women economically and politically unequal. And these are questions that the suffragists were concerned about, even dating back not just 100 years ago, but 150 years ago, 170 years ago. And so I think we're going to have to continue to think about those problems. And the Equal Rights Amendment is a way in which we can start to address those problems. It's not a total panacea or solution.
No, but it's a start.
It is a necessary beginning. Yes.
Indeed. Well, fascinating chatting to you. I love these programs because I learn so much on them. It really gets me. But we're running out of time, so what I'm going to do now is hand the show over to you so you can tell everybody where people can find out more about you and, of course, your book.
Great. So one way in which people can find out about my book and many of the conversations I'm having around the issues that are discussed in the book, including additional blog posts and op-eds. I had an op-ed last week in the LA Times, for example. I usually tweet those out, so you can follow me on Twitter at Julie C. Sook, and also on Instagram by the same handle, at Julie C. Sook. And I also have a website, juliecsook.com, where I post updates and reviews and any media appearances related to my book or any other media appearances related to the issues that I write and research about, including women and the law, anti-discrimination law, and constitution.
Okay, well, Julie, thank you so much for being a guest. It's been really interesting, and I'm sure a lot of people apart from myself have learned a lot of things, and good luck with the book.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Well, there you go. My guest today, Dr. Julie C. Sook. And that's J-U-L-I-E, C middle, and Sook is S-U-K. Sook, S-U-K. And we've been talking about her book, We the Women, The Unstoppable Mothers of the Equal Rights Amendment. Fascinating stuff. They're going back a long time in history, a lot of people along the way. And as we heard, it's still not quite there. You know, hopefully, you never know, next year, year after, a lot of people still pushing for it, but it's a start. We've got to start on it, and let's just hope we get a development to make everybody the same. Anyway, that's it. I will be back tomorrow, but until then, as always, we have one thing left to say. Don't forget. Make sure it's working.